This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 74, and very excited. I got a couple of guests that I consider friends, and very excited to have them on, Dr. Dana Stone and Dr. Jessica Chen Fang. They are going to be talking about their recent book, Finding Your Voice as a Beginning Marriage and Family Therapist. And although it's directed at MFTs, I think this episode will apply to, you know, counselors and social workers and psychologists, all kind of finding their voice as they enter into the field. And I just think you'll find it really, really helpful. Just one quick announcement. As always, please share the podcast widely. Come to our social media on Instagram, Facebook, etc. And of course, please rate and review the show on iTunes if you can. That's how we get out in front of people. If you like the ideas that are coming at you from this podcast and you want to share them, we would appreciate that. Please do that. And I do have stickers. If you want Radical Therapist stickers, please just shoot me an email and I'll mail them out to you. So, okay, let's get to the show. So I'm going to introduce you to Dr. Dana Stone, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist and an associate professor at California State University Northridge in the Marriage and Family Therapy Program and is an AMFT approved supervisor. She identifies as Black, white, biracial, and is the first person in her immediate family to achieve degrees in higher education. Her research includes deepening understanding of the biracial experience, expanding the meaning of culturally sensitive supervision, and exploring diversity in the field of MFT. And Jessica Chen Fang, Dr. Jessica Chen Fang, is also a licensed marriage and family therapy and is associate professor of medical education and associate director of physician vitality at Loma Linda University in California, my alma mater. And an AMFT-approved supervisor, her research, writing, and clinical work centers around socio-contextual issues such as gender and power, Asian American identity, and spirituality. She identifies as a second-generation Taiwanese American liberative educator and lives in Montclair, California. And they're going to talk about their book, Finding the Voice as Beginning Marriage and Family Therapist. And this book is meant to provide support to early therapists who are seeking authentic and meaningful connections with themselves, their colleagues, and the clients they serve. And without further ado, let's meet Dana and Jessica. All right. Welcome to The Radical Therapist, Jessica and Dana.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having us.
Yes, I'm very excited to have this conversation. Okay, so I guess just kind of to start, you wrote a book, Finding Your Voice as a Beginning Marriage and Family Therapist, and you were looking to support early career MFTs or marriage and family therapists, and you were, as I understand it, this book addresses a lack of resources for early career therapists during their professional formation, particularly for those who have a marginalized identity. And I'm wondering if, just kind of to start, can you tell us about the history of this book and what inspired you to write it together?
Yeah, it's a great story. Dana, you want to start?
Sure. I think how we started this process was really when we started working together at CSUN. Jessica came into the program as a core faculty member when I had been there for a few years. And I remember during her interview process, her research and her presentation really spoke to me because it was really centered in who she was, aspects of her identity, kind of who, what informed her in her career and her development. And I remember just being so excited to see a professional who was really connected to the work that they were doing. And it reminded me that that was important to me too. And that my research had been centered in things that were really important to me and aspects of my identity. And so during that time that I felt inspired. I don't know that I knew we would do something this amazing together, but I felt inspired by her story and kind of her presentation, and she was hired. And so that sort of started our relationship.
Yeah. And I think there are probably two parts to this. One, like Dana's mentioning, was our friendship and the working relationship we developed. And I think, you know, in those years that we worked together, it was so great to, after class, we would debrief about classroom dynamics, how it was impacting us, our concern and care for the students that we were teaching. And so it was this friendship that was building. And I know I felt just very safe and comfortable disclosing to Dana whatever I was thinking about, whatever I was wrestling with, the things I was learning. And so we just had this informal space in our connection, and that was huge. I always tell, you know, people who are doc students now or people who are trying to do publications and they're deciding who to write with, like, write with people you like. And that's how you get stuff done. And so anyways, maybe we can get to that, but it was through a conference, right? We submitted a presentation, workshop presentation to an AMFT conference. It was accepted. And maybe the topic is something helpful to talk about. Essentially, I think, was this around the 2016 election, Dana?
It was before, I think.
Okay. I just remember there was a lot of questions from students. Even within ourselves, people were asking, how do I have these difficult conversations about social context and identity with someone I'm getting to know, someone who may not be open to it? And that's kind of what our presentation was about. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes. And it was really, honestly, I think one of the biggest things about that was we started talking about As we started working together, we shared our research and kind of our interests, but that really evolved into more conversations about who we were as people, our experiences as students, our experiences as developing clinicians, and what we noticed was missing from our experiences or what we wished we had had. And we were generating those conversations with each other and thought maybe other people might want to engage in those conversations too. And so that's how we prepared the presentation. And it was really from our own experiences. It was so personal. But we thought, I think if I was a student and I saw a presentation like this at a conference, I would want to go. And a lot of people came, which was amazing. It was so amazing. It was just a room full of students. And I remember standing up there with Jessica and being so honored and so humbled and so grateful that our willingness to sort of put something like this out there spoke to exactly who we hoped it would speak to, including, interestingly enough, a publisher.
Yeah. Wonderful. You said something about what you had hoped for and wished for when you were kind of studying. And I wonder if you could share a bit about what ideas and or frameworks are missing from MFT or counselor education that you were trying to bring forward in this book.
I think the theories come a bit later. So part of it for me was, Dana and I were talking about our supervision and mentorship of a lot of students of color, for example, right? Or students who were first generation college students, let alone grad students. And they were wrestling in their other supervisory relationships, feeling like they couldn't talk about maybe their Mexican heritage or Asian cultural dynamics. And it totally triggered my own traumatic experiences from when I was trained and my early years of supervision, and essentially recognizing we have a field of supervisors and educators who have zero clue that the student or trainee's identity, self-identity, is everything in the process. I struggled with a whole year, if not more, of anxiety going into sessions, you know, being the youngest and only Asian person in the group therapy context. My supervisor had no idea how to talk to me about that. And of course, I was in my early 20s. How was I to know to bring it up, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't even know why I was so anxious. So anyways, it was because of that type of experience as a supervisor, recognizing it in the supervisee, and then remembering it very vividly for myself, like, wow, that was not a fun time. And I almost left the field because of it. So anyways, that made it very clear. These are missing things.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. It was supervising, becoming a supervisor myself also, that helped me to recognize that the challenges I had had as a trainee were like valid. I hadn't thought about it. I thought I was the only one. I had a sort of imposter syndrome when I was in my early graduate experiences and my early traineeship. And it was when the first student of color, one of the only students of color in a program I was teaching in, approached me and said, "Hey, I'm wondering if I could talk to you about some of these things that I'm experiencing as, you know, this only person with this only identity in this space." And I remember thinking to him, "Yeah, yes, please talk to me." And it was student after student after student that I just started to realize, like, oh my gosh, this is missing. This was missing for me, and it is missing. And so that definitely was an inspiration for, it was a huge part of our conversations.
Okay. In this book, you encourage early career therapists to think about the ways in which their social cultural identity intersects with and can be integrated into their development as a clinician. I'm wondering if you could say more about this.
Yeah, you know, one of the things for me, and I'm sure Jessica will say a little bit more, but one of the things for me was this idea, this sort of image that I had had in my own mind of what a therapist should look like, what they should be, how they should be. And the image wasn't me. And what I was realizing was that the image wasn't some of my students. Like, they didn't see themselves. They don't see themselves in the theorists. They don't see themselves in some of the leaders in the field, et cetera. And so one of the things that really stood out to me was I felt like I had to suspend aspects of who I was as a first-generation college student, as a biracial woman, as someone who maybe had different ideas or different values or different belief systems. I didn't think I could bring that into my early career as a therapist. And what I realized is, as I was developing as a therapist, how important all of who I was to the process of becoming a therapist. But I thought I had to suspend those things based on feedback, just sort of some of my early experiences. And so that was why I think Jessica and I came together and started talking about, like, how can we encourage people to bring all of who they are? Because all of who they are is what makes them a good clinician.
And I love what Dana just shared, this idea of having to suspend yourself. And I think the consequence of what I realized I experienced and I was seeing students experience is being more and more invisible. Mm-hmm. So when we think about any person with a marginalized background, if in their training context, they're not being seen and valued because of their identity, that starts to go back and they start to hide it. And it's the same thing that all of us are experiencing in society. And I think for myself, you know, if we're training clinicians to support, you know, populations that are marginalized, people who are wrestling with life and society, and we're not able to see and value our own selves, and our training context isn't doing that, how are we going to really support clients and future generations? And so I realized that this is a whole nother topic, but the Asian American invisibility, I had already experienced that a lot in my life. And then going into the training room as a therapist, it was further happening. I was losing myself. And so, of course, if you feel that, you feel totally unfit and no one's there to tell you, oh, this is what's happening. What a supervisor is telling you is, hey, you don't know how to talk about emotion. Can you elicit emotion even more from your clients? When actually, culturally, I was never modeled how to do that. And is that a deficit? Sure, maybe, because if I want to use EFT, I'm not equipped yet to do it. But it's not, then I start to feel like something's problematic with me, right? So anyways, we saw that a lot with our supervisees. And, you know, the hope is, as Dana mentioned, we start to invite all of these parts of our students and trainees into the room. They feel seen. They can do that for their clients. And they are excited to be clinicians in the field. Yeah.
That's great. Okay. In this book, you subvert the traditional role of therapist as someone who is a neutral expert in the therapeutic relationship, a person that develops clinical skills and applies theory and interventions to the therapist as a collaborative, engaged participant in a therapeutic relationship, where the therapist's social identity matters completely and it shapes the experience and direction of clinical work. And I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
I think that I really value models of therapy, and I really value kind of the history of our field. Systems thinking really makes sense to me, thinking of people in context. But what I know now that maybe I didn't know a long time ago is that I have been thinking about context beyond just the family system. I've been thinking about context, the individual within the family in the community in the society, so much more broadly, which I guess speaks to, you know, postmodernism and other other philosophies. And so for me, I think the willingness to consider the individual within all of those contexts, so the clinician specifically, and encouraging them to do that, I think invites possibility. It expands the things that we know are good and great in our field. I think it makes it better. I think it enriches it. I'm not sure I'm answering the question.
No, that was good. Jessica, you want to?
Yeah, I'm thinking about, so I feel like there are practical implications to this question, but also the theoretical piece. Maybe at the theoretical level, I'm thinking about the therapist as expert in a neutral position versus a therapist who has this knowledge and training and yet maintains a humility and an openness to that process. And I think that might be where Dana and I try to highlight the development of the therapist is while, yes, we are learning all these theories, we're practicing, we understand family systems, whereas maybe the client does not yet, what we want to maintain an openness to is while I might understand through past experiences, you know, maybe I'm working with another second generation Taiwanese American cis hetero woman like myself, but I don't know she may not have the same experience as me. And so I am not an expert on her life in a sociocultural sense. And so, I mean, it sounds kind of simple.
simple, but not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that regard, we're not experts, but I think the neutral piece is interesting. This is probably debated in a lot of places now, but because of our identities and we embrace all of it, I can never be neutral. My life experiences shape me in such a way where I have not only perspectives about something, but I've been impacted. You know, if someone is talking about racism or sexism, I am not a neutral party. I have emotional reaction. It's a whole nother conversation what we do with that. But I think assuming from the beginning, it is impossible for me as a human being with relationships with people in the world to come from a neutral place.
Yeah. Right, right.
Can I just add to that a little bit?
Sure, of course.
I wanted to say that piece about neutrality, I concur, absolutely. And I think when we encourage therapists in training to be more of who they are, I think part of what I want to bring to the forefront is, or encourage, is the willingness to acknowledge who you are, how you've lived, where you've been, what you've encountered, and how that shapes even your understanding of therapy or a model of therapy. And that if we don't acknowledge that, I think those models of therapy can fall flat. I think that we are trying to be something, possibly trying to be something that we're not. Mm. And I know a lot of trainers of supervisors and trainers of therapists don't agree with me, but I believe that who the person of the therapist is so critical in to acknowledge, to highlight, to, because I just think that sometimes that gets lost in formality. Mm-hmm. And I respect structures in place. You know, there's a lot of things that I think are really important for our field that I really respect, but I think that that is something that's missing. That when we say everyone needs a therapist and not every therapist can fit for everyone, or there's not a certain type of therapist for everyone, if that makes sense. I sit across from students, all different kinds of students. I just had a conversation last week where I said, you are important. You belong here, because this student was feeling like they don't belong in the field. They don't see themselves represented. They have different values, different views, whatever it might be. And they're worried that they don't belong. And I listen to them with my whole heart, and genuinely believe that they belong here. And I think sometimes we don't acknowledge how important, I'm going to use the word diversity, is. But not just what we think of as diversity, but like really unique aspects of people that I think is critical to our field and to the helping profession that we have that kind of representation. Yeah.
Yeah. You touched on the person of the therapist, or, you know, the self of the therapist. And that was going to actually be my next question. And in my work as an educator and supervisor, et cetera, I'm always interested in the work around self of the therapist or person of the therapist. And I'm wondering how the both of you kind of conceptualize that in the book. And for our listeners too, I mean, some people probably might not have ever heard of that term. So if you can kind of give us your conceptualization, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'm probably not going to be citing this directly from our book, just who we are, as Dana and I have both been in sharing here already. Who we are is important. It's valid. It needs to be seen in the therapy room. But it's not so easy, right, to do, because just like so many other parts of our lives, we have filters. We have things that we put up in order to be a particular type of person. And I think as educators in the MFT field, wanting to recognize, how do we contribute to people putting up those filters? And as Dana was sharing earlier, I was thinking about, and I don't even know if I'm using psychoanalysis and Bowen correctly here, but I think socioculturally, we repress a lot, right? We repress our experiences of racism, of heterosexism, of whatever ism to show up in the room. But if it's not being looked at in our own lives, if we're not working through it, recognizing our own trauma, our pain, it's going to start showing up. And we can't be that neutral, responsive therapist Bowen says we should all be because we're not dealing with it. And so I think, the self of the therapist work is about saying, hey, our craft of being a therapist, this amazing work we get to do, it goes hand in hand with the personal work that we do. And not only is that fulfilling and meaningful for our self-growth, but the impact of it is long-term and ripples through the clients, their families, and the communities that they're a part of too.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. And I would just add, you know, I think it is important to acknowledge some of the people in our field who use that language historically. So Virginia Satir, and more recently, Harriet Ponte. And there's a whole history of self of the therapist and person of the therapist literature. And I think that Satir's framing of person of the therapist or self of the therapist always spoke to me. But I realize in my conversations with Jessica, in my conversations with students, that I have sort of evolved my own meaning and understanding of self of the therapist work. And I think, I don't know if I've thought about it this way really concretely before, but I think as we're talking about it today, and as Jessica and I have sort of presented on this topic quite a bit, one of the things that is becoming more clear to me is that I think we're evolving our own ideas around self of the therapist work in a socioculturally sort of attuned way, that self of the therapist work is really about, this is another aspect of it. It's not just about our family histories and all of those things that are also really important, but our own development as people dealing with some of these issues, because we believe that that is also a part of thinking. I shouldn't say we, but I believe that it's part of my thinking systemically, going back to my first comment about when I think systemically, I'm thinking about this individual and all of these influence, but also all of these aspects of their identity and their sense of self. And that's when I think about that, that's the self of the therapist. It's the individual, all these aspects of their identity within their family, within their community, within society. That's how I think of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking, there's a Jack Halberstam quote about that. And sometimes I think that that work involves us really taking a hard look at how we've colluded with things like sexism and racism and stuff like that. And I think that's what you're talking to, Dana, it sounds like, you know, taking a look at the bigger picture. Yeah.
That idea of how I think we have to ask ourselves how we've colluded with it and also how we've internalized it.
Sure. Yeah.
As well. And I think that's part of when Jessica and I were sharing our stories and our histories with each other, and we still have those conversations today, a part of what we were recognizing in ourselves is what we had internalized, that internalized sort of oppressive systems or systems of oppression.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that. And I'm wondering now if, can the both of you share a story of a transformational moment that happened early in your career?
There's all kinds of transformations, right? Right. Moves us toward.
It's a big question. I'm sorry.
Healing, or I think I want to share something from, it wasn't the start of my training, because I went into a master's program in 2005, but it really wasn't about until 2010 when I started the doctoral program that I had what I would call truly transformative experiences. And it had a lot to do with my learning context, which is why I think this book has been such a project of passion and personal investment for Dana and myself, is because we experienced healing through our educational contexts and through relationships in academic spaces. So, you know, there wasn't anything in particular, but the gist of those few years for me was most of my peers and faculty were white. And if you know, listeners don't yet know, I'm an Asian American woman. And in my previous training, I was used to waiting to speak until the very end. I mean, just culturally, that's a huge part of my upbringing, is not interjecting myself into a space, because it's kind of experienced as disruptive, disrespectful. So I barely had a voice early on, but then it was through these research groups we had. Our classes were really quite small, and both the faculty and my peers started to really see me and value what I had to say. And I remember from comments like one professor telling me that my writing was good and that I should write more. I mean, that was life-changing, because you know what I internalized was, my mom taught me growing up, because we're Taiwanese and your parents are immigrants, you have to work not only twice as hard, but so much harder, because your English isn't going to be as good as someone else's, which implied your writing is not going to be as good. And so I never, ever thought in a million years I would be writing. And then I had, you know, other white older faculty tell me that my ideas mattered. I mean, it seems so basic, but it's like in my late 20s is when I started to realize, even as this model minority Asian who did get a lot of good grades, but I finally started to believe in myself, right? That's huge. That was totally transformational for me. And I'm grateful for those faculty and those friends who contributed to me feeling like I mattered and I have value and what I have to think and say is worthwhile in the world. Yeah, that's something that comes to my mind.
Mm-hmm. I so relate to you, Jessica. And I think that's one of the things, Chris, I'll just say about Jessica and I, every time we talk, we share things and like discover things. And oftentimes when I'm listening to Jessica, it brings up aspects of my own story, my own experience that I feel so validated. And I think that speaks to the relational piece that is a part of the book. And it's obviously a part of therapy and it's a part of even the field. But that relational piece of this process and how important it is to feel, to see and hear other people, but then also to feel seen and heard and understood just by listening to other people's stories. So I can really relate to Jessica's story of transformation and could say, yes, I'll share a story just like that. But I think I'll just say it really centered in my students. Having mentorship from faculty and having faculty in my master's program, actually, I would say all the way back to undergraduate, having a few faculty really see me and see my potential was significant, and it propelled me forward in ways. And I also had experiences with faculty that really silenced me and set me back. And I would say that happened in undergrad and grad school as well. And so those experiences were really challenging and I had self-doubt. But what helped to dissipate my self-doubt was just by the nature of being me and doing my best, when I started teaching master students in marriage and family therapy, and those students started coming to me because they felt like they could. And I think, of course, that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to create a space for my students and supervisees to come to me and talk to me and process what they needed to process on their journeys. But I don't think I knew how to do that. And yet, just by being me and being genuine and not being something other than who I was, I created spaces that, for the lack of better words, felt sacred. When students would come and share their experiences, mostly centered around race, gender, maybe even sexual orientation, as clinicians developing and feeling, experiencing some ism or a sense of isolation or not feeling like they could be whole, and wanting to be able to talk about that with someone and choosing me to talk to, I think, yeah, that was transformational. And it continues to be every time a student comes to me to this day. I feel that I have that feeling of this is an honor and a privilege to be in this space and for this person to feel safe enough to trust me on this really significant journey in their life. And so I think that is validation that I'm doing something. I don't even know if right is the word, but that I'm doing something important.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, a couple more questions. If you were to summarize ideas, tasks, advice, what you think all early professionals need to know or understand, what would stand out for you? I know it's another big question, but what would stand out for you? What's your quick, this is your need to know for early professional?
I'll just say one thing right away, relationships. Building relationships. So, you know, family relationships, you know, partner relationships, those things, yes. But in the field, finding people who you feel connected to, who you can relate to. I think relationships are so key, so critical. All different kinds. Close ones, ones where you can talk about research, ones where you can do, you know, but relationships, I think, is really important.
You know, I totally agree with Dana. For sure, we all need that close support network. And it's because what I would encourage people to do is to dive deep. I think what I mean by that is go deep. Use this time in your training and in the season of your life to really explore who you are, the people close to you. Really get into, you know, MFT theories and ideas, and but ask those really good questions. I did not learn how to think critically until much later in life. And I remember in elementary school, they would teach us how to think critically about this paragraph you just read. I mean, none of that was helpful for really looking at self-identity, but I just think it's such a special time in your life to be in training, to be learning and expanding your mind. And so, you know, go deep with the care of those relationships that you develop. Yeah.
That's great. Okay. Last question. I always like asking this question. Finally, what books, ideas, people are capturing your attention these days?
That's a huge question too. You know what I will say? I will say personally, I have been really trying to read more fiction. I've been a voracious reader since I was quite young, but grad school really got me off of reading for pleasure, because who has time to read for pleasure when you're in grad school? And I've been out of school for a long time now, but I've been really diving deep into fiction, and I have been being very conscientious about the fiction I'm reading. So I've been choosing books by women, women of color, and I've been really critical about the books I'm reading, that they're from the perspective of own voices. And so I like to read lighthearted stuff because I read a lot of really heavy stuff to prep for teaching and to make sure that I have a solid foundation. And so I've been reading things that are really light and funny and sometimes fluffy, but then also, you know, some other really beautiful stuff. So I've been reading books by, I read a lot of young adult fiction. Helen Huang. There's a woman who writes book, her last name is Sal Salvato, and she wrote this book called Poet X and The Fire on High. I've just been like trying to read books by people of color, women of color, stories about people that I didn't see when I was younger, and it's becoming much bigger. And so that's like lighthearted stuff that I'm excited about now. And I just constantly tell my students about books that they should be reading. The Hate U Give, On the Come Up, all young adult books. I'm just going to be honest.
Fun.
Is The Hate U Give, is that Mark?
The Hate U Give, I should tell you the author, but I need a second to think about it.
I think it's Mark Ashiro. Is that
something? It's a woman author.
Oh, it is. Okay.
And that book is amazing. There's a film out too, but the book is phenomenal. Okay. I should know it. I should know all this stuff. You know, I work with so many people who have authors memorized, and I should be better about that.
How about you, Jessica?
I'm totally going to look into some of those books.
Angie Thomas.
Mm. Oh, that's right. And there's the film that's out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, the last book I read that totally shook me up was Chanel Miller's book, Know My Name.
I'm so reading that too.
Yeah. There are two parts of my life these days outside of work. One is understanding the experiences of patriarchy and sexism for women, right? I think anytime someone identifies as a woman, lives in the world as a woman, you just have such deep connection with whatever those experiences are. And so I've been fascinated with like the Weinstein, the Jeffrey Epstein stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But then Chanel Miller's book, I mean, even whether or not someone has had, I don't know, you know, been raped or assaulted in any other way, right? However that was experienced by a woman, I mean, you identify with this inner world and mind that she really beautifully walks the reader through. And so anyways, it was really heavy. It's a heavy read. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact too that she is biracial and half Chinese, mm-hmm. and her relationship with her sister, all of that. It's an amazing book. So that's one part of my life. The other part of my life, what I've been getting really into, and Dana knows this, is slow fashion. So it's an interesting thing to talk about, but why it impacts me is this. I feel like when we're academics, we, to some degree, we can't help but feed right into capitalistic, you know, forward moving, success oriented pathways, right? It's like, what's next? What do I need to do next? What do I need to be next, accomplish next? I think it just goes hand in hand with capitalistic ideas and this idea of consuming. So my promise to myself this year is I'm not buying any new clothes. And if I do, I'm buying fabric and I'm trying to sew it. I'm trying to like create it. And on you know, social media, there are all these movements from people of color, women of color, who are showing the work that they do. And the other part of slow fashion that's neat is so that women aren't buying into the image of beauty or fashion that's being prescribed for you, but rather you're discovering for yourself what fabrics, what textiles, what colors, what things feel good for you and your body. So there's this very like physical component to it that is just so grounding for me. Actually, people can't see, but I'm wearing a turtleneck that I made myself and a jacket that I made myself. So it's been really meaningful, you know, the time I have to do that. So anyways, it's been fun.
That's awesome.
And Jess, can I relate on sewing too? Because I started sewing post-graduation because I wanted to do something creative. I love to do things creatively. And so I started sewing when I graduated from my PhD program. It was a goal I had before I started school. And it's so freeing and it's so centering. So I love seeing what Jessica's doing now because it's something that I found so much fulfillment from, which sounds really cheesy, but it's amazing.
And actually it's a good place to end because people might know our book cover is an image of Dana's quilt. Dana does amazing quilting and we have one in our house because it belongs to our son. But there's so much represented, I think, in the things that we create with our hands because it's an outpouring of what's in our hearts and our minds and our relationships. So, yeah.
That's wonderful. Thank you. All right. Thank you both. Okay, listeners, the book is Finding Your Voice as a Beginning Marriage and Family Therapist. It's Routledge. Is that how you say that? Is the publisher? Yep. And I want to thank you both for coming on and making the time. And it's always a pleasure to speak with you. And I get to do it sometimes off the podcast. So it's always enjoyable. So thanks for the conversation. And I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Yes, we've enjoyed being here.
All right, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. And like I said earlier, we are on all the social medias. You can find us on Instagram at The Radical Therapist, on Twitter at The Rad Therapist, and on Facebook, we have a Radical Therapist page that's fairly active. Go check that out. What else do I want to say? Do have stickers? Please spread the word. Please rate and review the show. So we can get out there and I got more episodes are coming. So as always, my name is Dr. Chris Hoff. Thanks for listening.